Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the just-released draft of the Republican Senate's repeal and replacement of Obamacare bill that Mitch McConnell is determined to get passed by the 4th of July holiday in a grotesque perversion of patriotism as Republicans are poised to celebrate millions of their fellow citizens losing health care coverage in order to make a handful of their richest patrons even richer. A veteran of the health insurance industry, Wendell Potter, who was chief corporate spokesman at Cigna and health of corporate communications at Humana, joins us to discuss what has emerged from secret behind-closed-doors negotiations and the unseemly rush to get something passed before it can be studied or scored to assess its impact in order to fulfill a Trump campaign promise so that Republicans can move on to the important work of reforming taxes to further enrich the wealthiest Americans like Trump and his family. Then we'll get an assessment of the Democrats' recent loss in the most expensive House race in history and why they ran such a bland candidate with a feckless message, and whether by reaching so high they gave Trump a gift and squandered millions of dollars of small donations from concerned citizens who are alarmed by Trump's reckless and destructive presidency. Simon Rosenberg, the president and founder of the New Democratic Network, a leading progressive think tank and advocacy organization, joins us to discuss the kind of messages and candidates the Democrats need to take back the House and Senate in 2018. Then finally, we will speak with John Lawrence, a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington, who worked for 38 years in the House of Representatives and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's chief of staff. He joins us to discuss unrelenting Republican attacks on Pelosi, as well as some criticism of her leadership from a few Democrats, and the underlying reason why she is the target of Republicans, not because they see her as a weak leader, but as a strong one. And joining us now is Wendell Potter, who, after a long career in the for-profit health industry as chief corporate spokesman at Cigna Corporation, as head of corporate communications at Humana, Inc., he is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity and the founder of Tarbell.org. His new book is Obamacare, What is in it for me? What everyone needs to know about the Affordable Care Act. And his latest book is Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendell Potter.
Thank you, Ian.
And Wendell, I find this really obscene that McConnell and these Republicans are just rushing this thing through, keeping it out of the light of day as much as they can, trying to get it passed by the 4th of July weekend so that they can go off and celebrate the fact that they're ripping the safety net out from millions of their fellow citizens. They're putting, you know, we don't know how many millions are going to be thrown off healthcare rolls and off insurance coverage. The last time it was 23 million. It may well be even more. What is there to celebrate? This is grotesque.
It is. The words obscene and grotesque really do apply because of the damage that it will do to so many lives, so many families. If this were to become law, and of course, there's a very good chance it will, with their being in control of both the House and the Senate and the White House, there's no reason. You know, it's clear why they were doing this in secret, just because it is every bit, if not worse, than anyone's worst expectations. It will really pretty much shred the safety net that we've had in this country. It'll decimate the Medicaid program in most states. And it will. One thing that is going unnoticed by a lot of commentators is that for those who think they have decent coverage right now, that will not last very long. Premiums will go up. Out-of-pocket expenses will go up for many, many people. Older people will have to pay very much more. So even those who continue to be able to have coverage of some nature will find that it's of less value.
Well, President Obama, who's pretty silent as the Trump administration has lurched from one bad headline to the other, and there's been ample opportunity to criticize President Trump, but he hasn't taken advantage of it. But he did seem to come out today. It's obviously really got to him. Let me just quote from President Obama's Facebook post. The Senate bill unveiled today is not a health care bill. It's a massive transfer of wealth from middle class and poor families to the richest people in America. It hands enormous tax cuts to the rich and to the drug and insurance industries, paid for by cutting health care for everybody else. Those with private insurance will experience higher premiums and higher deductibles, with lower tax credits for helping working families cover the costs, even as their plans might no longer cover pregnancy, mental health, or expensive prescriptions. Discrimination based on pre-existing conditions could become the norm again. Millions of families will lose, and millions of families will lose coverage entirely. I mean, this is a Again, this is an obscenity, and this is what I don't understand. What's happened to the kind of moral, compass of this country? Why do people think this is okay? Because just to help out this reckless, incompetent president who made all these ludicrous campaign promises? What's going on here?
Well, it's showing the true colors and the true philosophy, and it's showing contempt, and complete contempt for people who are not wealthy, who are not well-to-do. It's an Ayn Rand kind of philosophy and kind of legislation. It's what she undoubtedly would have advocated herself. And of course, Paul Ryan is one of her acolytes. And essentially it is a philosophy of, only the fittest deserve to survive to a certain extent. And if you haven't made it now, if you're not already well off, then you are just expendable and too bad, so sad. It's that kind of philosophy. They bought into the notion that government is bad and that any kind of taxation that helps people get a leg up and helps them get care that they need is inappropriate, and that it's just fine to do this massive transfer of wealth, as you mentioned, that the president mentioned, from the former president, from the poor and the middle class to the already wealthy. It is truly obscene and truly, I've been around politics and legislation. I used to cover Congress many, many years ago, back in the 70s. I have never seen a piece of legislation that is this mean and this evil, quite frankly.
But Trump himself said the House bill was mean, and this looks like it's even meaner.
It's even meaner, and if, I see a few of the conservatives who say they can't vote for it right now, the arch conservatives, Rand Paul being one of them, Ted Cruz being another, they want to make it even more cruel, even more heartless, before they say they will pass it. So I'm sure that whatever finally does get voted on will be even worse than what we're seeing right now. Now, there are a few so-called moderate members of Congress, like Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and maybe Portman of Ohio, who may not go along with this because it is so mean and will affect states in very adverse ways, because it will cut their Medicaid programs all across the country so drastically that maybe there'll be a few Republicans who say, we just can't stomach this and won't vote for it.
But not only is it mean, though, it's deceptive, because in getting rid of or cutting into Medicaid, they have a slower glide path towards its elimination, or its evisceration, I should say. But at the end of the day, it'll be worse off. So that strikes me as being quite cynical.
It's very cynical and very devious, very deceptive. And clearly, the worst of it will not be taking effect until after the midterms and even after the next presidential election. So it's gradual pain and suffering for so many people, and the worst of it will come after, a few years down the road. But I'm sure that they think that they can get away with this because of that, and because they're so good at messaging and deceiving people with the language and messaging that they use. They're quite expert at that and misleading people. So I think they think they may be able to pull this off and no one will be the wiser. And the sad thing is, of course, that a lot of poor people have bought into and voted for these people to put them in office, thinking that they actually might do something that would benefit them. But instead of that, it's taking advantage of them and ripping the safety net out from under them. And a lot of these folks are not as well educated, and they're more likely to be susceptible to deceit, you know, misleading PR campaigns, like I used to be a part of when I was in the industry. They know they can probably, I'm sure they consulted with a lot of consultants or hired a lot of consultants to help them get ready to sell this to the American public. And a lot of people will believe the BS that they sell.
So what's the connection here between this compulsion to push this thing through as fast as possible? My understanding is that they want to move on to that so-called tax reform, which is an even right. bigger prize, which means yeah. they can really reward their rich patrons even more. But what's the connection here between the need to pass this obscenity in order to do an even greater obscenity?
Well, it is by freeing up money that they can give to the rich folks through tax cuts. If you gut the Medicaid program by $800 billion, and more than likely it'll be even deeper than that when the Congressional Budget Office scores it, and other ways that they are taking money away from healthcare, I'm sure it will be close to $1 trillion that they'll be able to transfer or will have available essentially transfer to those who are rich in the form of tax cuts. So that's why they're rushing this through. They want to have that money available that will no longer go to the middle class and the poor, that they can give in the form of tax cuts to the wealthy.
But I don't understand the mentality of a Mitch McConnell and a Paul Ryan. It's one thing to enrich yourself and to transfer money to yourself, or even to steal it from the poor and give it to yourself. But to steal it from the poor and give it to the rich, why are they so, show such fealty to wealthy donors like the Koch brothers and others? Or do you think it's ideological? It's this Ayn Rand insanity? Because, you know, the irony is that she ended up on Medicare and Social Security.
Right, exactly. I think it's ideology. I think it is just contempt. I'll use that word again. I think that and I've seen this so many times over the course of my career, the ability of people like that to take advantage of poor people, to sell them a bill of goods, to sell them on campaign promises, to get people to vote against their own self-interest. And that's what's going on here. They do it time and time and time again, and it works for them. Whether this will work for them indefinitely, I don't know, because it will be creating a society that's even more unequal than it is now if it goes forward. When I say contempt, they clearly do not really care what happens to human beings. People will not be able to get the care that they need. Their lives will be shortened, and that will include children as well as grown people.
Well, in the last couple of minutes, the president himself, of course, when he was meeting with the Australian Prime Minister a while back, he said how great Australia's healthcare is. I don't know whether he realized it was a single-payer system, you know. Obviously, you can't expect any rationality and consistency from Trump or even any basic knowledge of policy. But again, you go back to that. You know, the rest of the world has a system that is called single-payer, not a very good term, doesn't really describe what it does. But essentially, it's a large pool that everybody is in, and it functions, and it cuts your healthcare costs. At this point, we're over 18% of GDP. It could cut it down to about 8% of GDP, and that's trillions and trillions of dollars that could be saved. And that would be better for every American, for every corporation, for every citizen. And there it is, staring at us like the 900-pound gorilla. And we can't make that leap. It's kind of pathetic, isn't it?
It's pathetic, but, you know, if there is anything that is a silver lining to this madness, it is that I think a lot of thinking people, including business leaders, will will recognize this, the evil that is what we're talking about. And they, too, a lot of business leaders I know and I've talked to in over the past year, realize even Obamacare did not give the kind of relief that they needed. It didn't do nearly enough to reduce costs. And I think there's going to be renewed interest and interest for the first time, maybe, among business leaders about single-payer. Just last month, Warren Buffett was describing the growth in medical costs in this country as the tapeworm that is destroying American business competitiveness. And his colleague, Charlie Munger, said, as a Republican, that it is time to start thinking and talking about transitioning to a single-payer system. So they being the Republicans, may unwittingly have paved the way for a serious consideration, maybe passage of something that would lead to single-payer.
But in the meantime, they're going to just really hurt a lot of Americans, kill a lot of Americans. That's not hyperbole. A lot of people are going to die, lot of people. It's bad enough to not have something, but to have something finally that gives you some protection, some security, so that your kids used to die in droves, only a few decades ago, and all of it can be cured, and kids with pre-existing conditions, and all these people paying, their life savings to buy a few pills to live a little longer. The whole system but the idea that you got a bad system and you're going to make it worse, that's just unconscionable.
It is, and the media will have an important role to play to expose this over time for what it really is. Although I don't have a lot of faith in the media, we haven't seen they're doing a whole lot that helps to keep bad things from happening. It's why I'm starting Tarbell.org, as you mentioned earlier, to help people understand what is really going on, to provide the context and to help point to solutions. And that's going to be so necessary in the months and years ahead.
And, of course, Tarbell's named after Ida Tarbell, the great muckraking investigative journalist back in the earlier Gilded Age when she exposed the Standard Oil Trust and led to the breaking up of the most powerful corporation in the world. So there's a model to follow, Wendell, and I thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Wendell Potter, who, after a long career in the for-profit industry, health industry, as chief corporate spokesman at Cigna Corporation, as head of corporate communications at Humana, he's now the senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity and the founder of Tarbell.org. His latest book is Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. And now we're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the kind of messages and candidates Democrats need in 2018.
I don't give a damn what the doctors say. I ain't gonna spend another lonesome day. I don't wanna die in the hospital. You gotta take me back outside. They don't let you smoke and you can't get drunk. All there is to watch are these soap operas. I don't wanna die in the hospital. You gotta take me back outside. Can you get this tube out of my arm? Morphing in my blood like a slow set.
That we learned, is it just a premonition? Could we really get ourselves both burned?
I've been sent here on a mission, find what we agree upon.
We don't agree about September.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Simon Rosenberg, the president and founder of the New Democrat Network, a leading progressive think tank and advocacy organization. Previously, he was a writer and producer at ABC News for 5 years before working on the Dukakis and Clinton presidential campaigns, where he was a member of the 1992 Clinton War Room. Welcome to Background Briefing, Simon Rosenberg.
Good to be here. Thank you, Ian.
So what happened to the James Carvilles in terms of Democratic political operatives? You're in the war room with him. Yeah. I mean, the Democrats win when they run a kind of macho liberal, which is arguably what Bill Clinton was. And there's no question that Carville's a tough customer. But when you run a wuss, you lose, and it's just, what is wrong with them? Why don't they find some big burly guy from the country who drives a pickup truck with a gun rack and
the guy who's running against Paul Ryan, whose Twitter handle is Iron Stash, right?
Right.
Mustache, but right. And as an iron worker. Listen, I first of all, I want to just say that I'm not in the panic camp. I mean, I didn't think we were ever going to win any of these specials. The fact that we came, you know, they were picked by the Trump White House to be unwinnable, right? They went into Kansas and Montana, South Carolina. These are not traditional Democratic bastions. This was a tougher district than people realized. And Georgia 6, it was a, you know, there are 71 districts that are more Democratic that are held by Republicans. This and the DCCC targeting list, this district was, you know, number 72, right? And we need to win 24. So, you know, my own view is that if you look at the election results from last night, I mean, from Tuesday night, and, you know, if that margin was true across the entire country, you know, the Democrats would have won the House back on Tuesday night. And I can go through the math of it, but the key here is that you shift the national landscape by 4 to 5 points, and you have 50 seats, more than 50 seats, are either even or lean Democrat. This was not one of those. This was, you know, number 72 on the list, right? But this, you know, that was a 5-point shift Tuesday night for this district. 5 points means that not only is the House in play, but it leans Democratic. And so, you know, look, we got a long way to go till fall of 2018. A lot could happen, but I think you know, we made substantial progress, and I'm frankly pleased with the results so far.
Yeah, but why raise expectations and waste $30 million or whatever they wasted on that race?
But it's not they. I mean, John Ossoff raised that money.
Right.
And the difference was that he raised that money. It was individual Democrats who gave that money and made that race close. The money spent by Karen Handel was spent by the Republican Party, largely. Mm-hmm. She didn't raise that much money. A lot of this, the biggest chunk of it came from Paul Ryan's super PAC. And so, you know, the most important thing here is that, look, if to catch a wave next year, if there's a 4, 5, 6 point shift in the national landscape, the single most important thing is for each individual Democratic candidate to be able to raise $5 or $6 million of their own money to make sure that their name is out there, people know that there's a choice. And well, the greatest lesson of this John Ossoff race is that Democratic donors are stepping up. Individual private Americans, regular everyday people, are writing $25 checks to these, you know, making $25 contributions online. That's what we need to win. I mean, if we have 70 well-funded candidates, forget about what the party does and the outside groups, but the candidates themselves who control their own dialogue and can get their name out there, you know, I think we'll win in 2018. So that was the other thing that was very encouraging, is that, you know, that the grassroots is engaged and ready to play. But look, certainly there's no question it's disappointing. I don't think expectations were raised. I mean, I've been in briefings with the DCCC. They always said this race was going to be tough. And I think for Democrats who are listening today, I think this is what we know, the bottom line. The House is in play. It can be flipped. But Trump and Paul Ryan are not going to roll over and play dead. And they're going to fight, and that this is going to be an extraordinary battle over the next year and a half.
Well, you still don't want to discourage people, and particularly people who gave money, arguably unnecessarily. I mean, we need the money later on. The idea of spending $57 million on a race that went on for a few weeks just seems obscene.
Right, but I mean, the point is that he had the money, and then
right.
He was spending. The Republicans had to match. I mean, we set the tone in that race, and our system, you know, look, we have a very decentralized political system in America, right? And individual people made up their mind to write John Ossoff, you know, a check. I mean, there wasn't that the money that he raised didn't come from wealthy people. It came from everyday people who used this race as a way to fight it, you know, to channel their frustration and anger towards Donald Trump into something constructive.
Right.
We came very close in this race.
Sure. Right?
Average margin of loss in this race over the last several elections has been 20 to 25 points. We came within 3 points. And so I think that my view is that what Democrats have to be able to do next year, to use a version of what you just said back to you, is that we got to leave everything on the playing field, right? We got 70 races. We don't know who's going to carry this over the finish line. I've been through this on both sides. you know, I've been on the Democratic wave, and I've been on the opposite side of a Republican wave when I've seen people lose. We don't know what this landscape is going to look like next year, and we don't know what this is going to be. But right now, one of the things that happened, all that money allowed Democrats to test a lot of messages, to learn to use new tactics and techniques that are specific to this cycle, the current wave of technology that's coming. And, you know, this has all been, I think that on balance, right, this has all been very, I think the Democrats in the House who are running these campaigns feel pretty good about what they were able to do. We made huge advances in using social media and digital advertising, which is something we had actually fallen behind the Republicans on. There were very significant, highly targeted, highly effective. So look, we just have to go on now. And we have new battles ahead of us every day with Donald Trump. And I think there will be two big governor's races in the fall in New Jersey and Virginia. These are winnable. These are much more favorable terrain for the Democratic Party. But no one should have any illusion that winning the House back is going to be easy. And I think one of the things that I've grown to learn about the Democrats, going back to the Carville analogy, is that, you know, I think we discount the power of the Republicans. We look at guys like Trump. We look at the Republican Party. Democrats think they're buffoons and they're crazy, and yet they keep winning, right? And I think, to your point, we've got to toughen up a little bit. We have to understand our enemy a little bit better than we do. We can't be so arrogant and so willing to discount people for being crazy and then not running proper elections to defeat them. I think one of the things that Hillary did is that Hillary never really understood who she was running against. In my view, I think that it became too easy for them to run against Donald Trump, the man, and not Donald Trump, the arguments, and that they became so obsessed with his personal failings that they lost strategic control of the race, and that they could have run a very different race, attacked him for, you know, many of his points of view about the world, which were equally troublesome as his own personal behavior. And so I think that one of the things we have to do is not view that anything that we're about to go do over the next 18 months is going to be easy. It's going to be hard. We're going to lose a lot of stuff. We're going to be disappointed a lot over the next 18 months. But we have to keep fighting. It's all we can do.
So with that in mind, Simon, then you, I imagine, think that it's not a good idea for the Democrats to be so invested in Trump self-destructing or getting impeached, that as crazy as he is and as appalling and as scary as it is to have somebody so unqualified and so reckless and a commander-in-chief who's completely AWOL, delegated everything, doesn't know what's going on. We haven't had a real crisis. God help us if we have a real crisis with this guy in charge. It's a difficult situation to be in, and I'm genuinely nervous for the country. But it would seem to me a much better idea not to focus on this train wreck in the White House, but rather what they're doing and what Ryan and McConnell are doing, right?
Right. I think that, look, I know we have time is short, so I'll try to do this as quickly as I can, and I share your concern about the country. I think Trump has been so much worse than any of us ever could have imagined, and scary to me, right? And I live this every day working in this business, and it's been, you know, it's been hard, I'm sure, for many of your listeners, and it's been hard for many Americans. But I think at a strategy level, we can't count on him being removed or being impeached. I mean, we have to assume that he's going to be in office for the next 3.5 years. And if that doesn't happen, then that's, you know, in my mind, that's good, right? But if it does, if he's there and he's fighting as he's capable of fighting, and if Ryan and these guys raise all the money that they're going to raise, right? You know, we have to toughen up here. And I think that we have to toughen up in a very specific way, right? I think there are two things we have to do in the next 18 months. And one is we have to become the responsible alternative to a reckless and irresponsible enterprise. And this healthcare bill is a very good example. You know, I mean, what a weird definition of patriotism that you would rush to strip 25 million people of their health insurance to help them celebrate the July 4th holiday, right? And I think that first of all, I think that, you know, candidates who are experienced, who have had real life experience, not 30-year-old kids, right, are going to be more effective for us, because I think on a certain level of positioning, we have to make a basic argument that when we've been in power, the country has prospered and gotten better. We've put these kind of reckless folks in charge, and we need a bunch of sober, serious people to come back in and run the country again and not let it go to hell, right? The second piece that I think that I'm excited about is that I think it also gives Democrats an opportunity to reclaim patriotism as something that's theirs and love of country. We were a patriotic party in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. I think the Vietnam War created a period of time where the Democrat, you know, traditional patriotism and love of country was complicated, or at least it manifested itself in different ways, right? I think what you're going to see now, that what Trump has done in the betrayal of the United States, the betrayal with foreign powers, the betrayal of working people, the sense that he's betrayed the country and is not honoring what makes us great, actually, gives us an incredible opportunity to reclaim patriotism in an organic and authentic way, right? And that when I think about, you know, fighting the health care plan to make sure 25 million people don't lose their health insurance, I'm doing that as a patriot, not as a partisan. When I want to make sure that Donald Trump is held to account for his dalliances with the Russians, you know, we're doing that as patriots. We're not doing that as partisans. And I think that, you know, this issue, when you add our economic success as a party, I think our social tolerance plus and layer on top of that a commitment to political reform and renewing our democracy and being proud patriots and not partisans, right? That's a very powerful combination. And I think that you're going to see a lot of veterans running this cycle. You're going to see, you already see veterans like Seth Moulton and Ruben Gallego, you know, asserting themselves in the political marketplace in Washington. And I think what you're seeing, Ian, is a new Democratic Party that's being born, a post-Clinton, post-Obama party that is going to grow out of this challenge, to your point, where things that we thought that were givens in life, the West, our NATO, right, the global order, right, these things are being challenged in ways that were unimaginable to us even a few years ago. And I think that out of that response will come, you know, could come a one of the most powerful manifestations of the center left in recent American life. And so I'm encouraged by what I'm seeing, because I think that the members of Congress that I'm working with, I think, are beginning to realize the gravity of the moment, right? That this is not a normal time, that this is something where history is calling them to be big, to be bigger and better than just a normal member of Congress. And I think you're starting to see people like Adam Schiff, for example, right, really emerge as, you know, incredibly powerful new voices, you know, that are deeply patriotic. I mean, I had lunch with Adam the other day, and I said to him, you know, Adam, you're our country's most important patriot now, right? And I really feel that in my bones. And so, you know, I'm not trying to be Pollyannish here. I mean, we got all sorts of challenges, right? But I also think it's too easy to dwell on the negative these days. I think part of what Trump has done is that he's brought a dark pessimism to the country that is infecting all of us. And part of our obligation in defeating Trump is to reject this ill-placed pessimism and to have a more balanced view of what is going right about America and a steely commitment to fix what's still wrong. And I think if we can do that, I think we're going to do really well next year.
Well, as Comey pointed out in those hearings, you know, the American people argue amongst themselves, but the idea that a foreign power could decide who elects us is just beyond the pale. And the idea that Donald Trump simply refuses to accept the intelligence community's consensus and is in total denial, if not in collusion, which hasn't been proven, but it certainly appears to be the case. This is extraordinary, but I don't think we can let the others off the hook too, the ones, the enablers, like Paul Ryan and McConnell,
yep.
Because the Republican Party itself, if you really look at it in cold light and not being partisan, I'm trying to my best not to be partisan, they rely on undemocratic means to maintain their majority status.
Yeah.
They rely
yep.
on gerrymandering. They rely on the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision that gives them unaccountable, untraceable, non-transparent piles of money. They rely on the Supreme Court getting rid of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act so that they can engage in voter suppression. And they have, in Trump's case, they've got this antiquated slave-era electoral college.
Well, and they stole a Supreme Court seat, right?
And they stole
to your list, right?
Right. So, in other words, can you make the case to the average American, and remember, most Americans are independents, not Democrats or Republicans. Can you make the case that these guys just don't play fair?
Yeah, I think that's part of, I think we have to sell it as part of the patriotism rap, right? That they're portraying the things that made this country great, that made us exceptional, right? That they are, that, you know, through, and I, you know, look, it's still early in the cycle and we're going to play with these things, but the stuff you're talking about, I've been writing about for years, and I believe that whether you call it renewing our democracy, whatever the banner is going to be, this has to be central to who we are. I mean, voters want to believe that we're going to make this political system better. You know, Trump did it in his own way, right? Which is, he said, I'm going to drain the swamp and all the stuff that he did. And I think we have to, you know, I think we were too comfortable in 2016 to be the party of the status quo in a time when people didn't want that. And so, yeah, I think you're right. And look, I want to just say one thing about this Russia thing, right? Because I tweeted on this today. Today, Donald Trump, today, not a month ago, 2 months ago, repeated that this whole thing about Russia is all a hoax and it's false and it's made up. And I just want to go on record saying that I believe this is grounds for removal of the president from office. That at this point, given what we know, his continued willingness to either lie, right, for political gain on something of this magnitude, or to not really understand what took place. We learned that Jeff Sessions last week, right, has never been briefed on this. That if you can't get this right, if you don't understand this, that we were attacked like 9/11, like Pearl Harbor, and that this is a matter of enormous significance to the country and our sovereignty and our ability to govern ourselves, and if you are unwilling to acknowledge publicly that that took place, you should not be president of the United States. And I think that this is legitimate grounds for removal of him. And I think that Democrats have to start talking this way, because it is not acceptable. It means that he is unwilling to do what's required to protect our country from a foreign hostile power. Far greater threat than anybody from one of the Muslim countries that he tried to ban people from coming in here, right? And I think that we've done, to the point that you raised earlier, and I know we're wrapping up, is that Democrats can't outsource their business to other people, to investigations, to outside organizations like Crew that are suing. We have to do this ourselves. We have to have a dialogue with the public about what's going on. We cannot hide from this. We have to talk about Russia and Trump, what he's doing. We have to talk about the stuff that you just talked about and their betrayal of our democratic principles and the weakening of democratic norms. We have to create a dialogue around this. And we're not. We're not. It's not central to what the Democratic Party is doing. It's not central to, you know, how we're approaching these things. And I think that we have an unbelievable responsibility and obligation to create a sensible dialogue with the American public about what the stakes are of the current moment. And I think we have not risen to the moment. I think certain members have, like Schiff, for example. But on broad brushes, I don't think we've done it adequately. And I think this is the great opportunity. And I do think that the country is ready to have a conversation. You know, look, my final point on all this is that what Trump did is he defined the terms of the election around the concept of American greatness, right? And he had an argument for how to make America great. We have to have our own argument about what makes America great. We have to have a rebuttal. We have to have an answer to that. And it can't be raising the minimum wage, right? That's not sufficient. It has to be around the basket of stuff that we're talking about tonight and how, you know, we have a vision for making America as great in the 21st century as we did in the 20th century. The Democratic Party doesn't have that vision today. We just don't. It's not what we've done. We've been more tactical than strategic, I would argue. And it's been reasonably successful for us. But things have changed, and we have to, history's calling on us, you and I and your listeners, to rise to the moment and really start to articulate, you know, how America can be great again in the 21st century after Trump's presidency, because we will have to work to make it great again after what he's done to all of us, right? So I appreciate the time tonight. Hopefully, you know, I can come back in. I know your show is as high-minded and thoughtful as any show that I ever get to go on. I appreciate the opportunity to spend some time with you tonight.
Well, thank you very much. And again, I've been speaking with Simon Rosenberg, the president and founder of the New Democrat Network, a leading progressive think tank and advocacy organization. Previously, he was a writer and producer at ABC News for 5 years before working on the Dukakis and Clinton presidential campaigns, where he was a member of the 1992 Clinton War Room. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with Nancy Pelosi's former chief of staff about Republican attacks and Democratic criticism of her. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is John Lawrence, a visiting professor at the University of California Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's chief of staff. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Lawrence.
Thank you very much, Ian. Good to talk with you again.
Likewise, John. And Nancy Pelosi, your former boss, is getting some flack, not just from the Republicans, which is entirely expected. They really did successfully demonize her in the race down there in Georgia, where they tied John Ossoff to her and sort of turned her into a monster in the same way that they turned Hillary Clinton into a monster. But she's also getting a little criticism from Democrats as well. So what do you make of that?
Well, you know, she has had some people voting against her when she has run for leader, and that goes back several terms, so I don't think that's that unusual. And I also think that given the amount of time that she has been the leader, she's you know, she has people who are interested in seeing others move up, or who are ambitious themselves in moving up. But I think she continues to retain strong support of her caucus, and I think that was reflected in her being reelected again in January to her position.
And she was challenged by Representative Tim Ryan. He said on CNN, you know what, the honest answer is that in some areas of the country, yes, she is, meaning she's not popular, and that's the honest answer. And the idea would be then you replace her as a better bet to go after these seats, these marginal seats like the 6th District that are red states. I mean, the system's been so gerrymandered that the Democrats don't have a lot of pickings, do they? They've got to somehow find a way to win over disaffected Republicans. Is that the theory for 2018?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, with respect to Congressman Ryan's remarks, sure, there are areas of the country where Mrs. Pelosi isn't popular. I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is whether or not these kinds of allegations that he and others make are accurate. That is, does Mrs. Pelosi serving as a Democratic leader hurt us in races and cost us seats that we otherwise would win? Of course, there are people in those districts who aren't happy with her or who don't like her, but my guess is that those are not the people who are likely to vote for the Democratic candidate in otherwise. So I think drawing that conclusion is the erroneous conclusion. What we need to do, what Democrats need to do, is to win some Republican votes, but really to win over independent votes and to turn out Democratic votes. Mrs. Pelosi has a track record of doing a very good job of turning out Democrats, of developing a message, of developing resources, of finding candidates. And if you look at what's happened in these elections, these four elections since January, the Republican margins in each of them has dropped by 15 to 20 points. There are over 90 seats that are currently held by Republicans where the margin is less than these seats, and where that kind of point shift would result in Democrats winning either very close or, in many cases, winning those seats. We only have to win 24. So I think that this is one of these situations where one needs to take a deep breath and make sure that the facts that one's using and the analysis one's using are actually consistent with reality. Mrs. Pelosi brings a great deal of strength to the Democratic caucus, and that's why she continues to win the support of the Democratic caucus.
But isn't there still, within what you just told us, the possibility of picking up 90-plus seats in these, shall we call them, purple states that have red representatives but could be flipped? Isn't there a dilemma there, in as much as you, if your candidate moves to the center to win over disaffected Republicans, he or she might well alienate the Democratic base?
I think Democrats in 2018 are going to be very focused on defeating Republicans in order to stop Donald Trump's agenda. The House of Representatives may well be the best opportunity for accomplishing that goal. So there's not a lot of evidence that Democrats on the left or to the left of center will refuse to vote for Democratic candidates. I think that on the key issues, whether it's health care or preserving education or developing jobs or a sound comprehensive immigration policy, I think Democrats are going to be very, very united. I don't think that the divisions within the party are going to be nearly as significant as the opposition to Mr. Trump. And you see that interest on the part of Democrats in running just by the number of people, now in excess of 500, who are saying they're going to file to run four seats in the House of Representatives next year, an increase of more than four times where we were just 2 years ago. So I think there's a great deal of interest, and I think that when we get down to the general election where it's Democrats versus Republicans as opposed to Democrat versus Democrat in a primary, I have very little doubt that Democrats are going to come home. And I think there are a large number of these seats, not 90, of course, but we only need 24, where independents and hopefully some Republicans are going to conclude that allowing the country to continue to be in this kind of inaction and daily chaos that the Trump administration has produced is not the best course, and that we need to bring Democrats back into control, at least in one house of the Congress, in order to provide that kind of balance and to force some negotiation. You mentioned gerrymandering, and gerrymandering obviously is a major problem, and the Supreme Court has now decided just this week to take a look at it because it is such a problem. But your listeners should also keep in mind that one of the downsides for gerrymandering for the majority that takes advantage of it, and overwhelmingly that is the Republican Party, which controls most state legislatures, which do reapportionment. When you do that, you tend to produce districts that have smaller majorities for your party. That's how you control so many seats, disproportionate to their number of votes that you get in the state. And so while they may have captured a lot of seats, they hold a lot of those seats with fairly narrow margins, and that is provides many, many opportunities for Democrats to run and run successfully in 2018.
But in terms of the demonization of Nancy Pelosi, because if you saw the ads that went on down in Georgia, and in television clips, it was very clear that Republicans were voting for Karen Handel because they'd seen these ads and they were essentially regurgitating the idea that Nancy Pelosi is some kind of monster and this guy, Ossoff, is going to be her puppet. That was just like a universal chorus. So they were successful. They clearly did an incredible job on demonizing Hillary Clinton, turning her into a monster. How do you deal with that? Because I don't believe that Nancy Pelosi is anything like the way she's been portrayed. I know she's got pretty thick skin, and she made a joke today about when they kept saying, "You're going to step down," and she said, "Do you expect me to sing my praises? I'm a master legislator. I'm a strategist, politically astute leader." She's a tough operator, but still, you got to admit that the Republicans and their surrogates do an incredible job. Going back to, remember, the strongest thing that John Kerry, when he's running against George Bush, had going for him, that he was a war hero and Karl Rove and company took that away from him. So they'll stoop to anything.
Well, yes, and having spent 8 years as Mrs. Pelosi's chief of staff, both as speaker and as Democratic leader, I am quite aware of the thickness of her skin and the depth of her determination. So I'm not under any misimpressions about that, nor should anyone else be. I think that the issue here, Ian, is not that the Republicans have used those charges against her, but whether or not that's the reason that Mr. Ossoff lost. Again, the Republicans have always gone after Mrs. Pelosi, and they go after her in many districts where the Democrats win. You know, in the House, maybe more so than in any other elective office in the United States, the individual candidate really matters. And in some cases, we have stronger candidates or we have weaker candidates. In the case of the Ossoff race, look, this is a district that has been in Republican hands since 1979. It's a district that the Republican candidate won by well over 20 points just 8 months ago. And yet we find the Democrat losing by only 4 points in the election this week. So I don't look at that kind of a trend line only 6 months into the Trump administration and conclude that Democrats are weak in that district. I look at it as Democrats have made enormous inroads in a solidly Republican district. Are they going to be critical of Mrs. Pelosi? Yes. Is that going to affect the outcome of the race? I don't think anybody's really demonstrated that, but for Mrs. Pelosi, these races would have ended up any other way. So I wouldn't put the causal connection quite between those two facts. And in the meantime, obviously, Mrs. Pelosi enjoys support in her caucus because she's good for the Democratic caucus in terms of raising money, in terms of developing message, in terms of recruiting solid candidates. And let's also keep in mind that one of the reasons she's very popular in that caucus is because she's been determined to put women and minorities into key positions on committees, to elevate them to ranking member and chairman status. She's been very determined about doing that, and people appreciate the fact that she hasn't just allowed the old seniority system to determine who rises in political power in the delegations and on the committees. Of course, that sometimes gives her, you know, makes her subject to criticism even within the caucus, and everybody understands that, including her. But I don't think that she is the single source of why these races have been unsuccessful. I think to look at that, you have to look at individual candidates, individual districts, and the voting trends in those areas. In those considerations, hard as it is to say, I would say that the trends of these four elections are quite positive rather than quite negative.
Well, I would assume that one of the reasons, the main reason why the Republicans are on this jihad against Nancy Pelosi is that she is effective. They wouldn't be going after her if she was a weak and unpopular leader as they are portraying her as. They're going after her because she is effective. But when you mentioned that she's been good in terms of choosing candidates, did she choose Ossoff? Because he was hardly a good candidate.
Yeah, I don't think she did. I think that, you know, in these special elections, people emerge and they emerge very quickly because of the timeline in these races. But, you know, we will have a number of candidates over the course of the next year who will be coming forward, who will present themselves, and I think will present themselves to the campaign committee and to voters and really try to make the case. And there'll be quite a selection of people who are presenting themselves, and that's where that kind of seasoned examination that she and the members of the caucus and the leadership will provide is going to be very valuable to be sure that we select the very strongest candidate. I don't want to say anything negative about Mr. Ossoff. I think, you know, he was running a tough race in a very Republican district, and he did a pretty good job. But a general election where there's a national message, that's a different situation than these one-off special elections.
So you think this call for her to step down, there's, you know, been a couple of Democrats, usually from red states like Texas, you could argue that they're worried about their own future, and on the other hand, you could also make the argument that they're basically caving in to a Republican jihad, as I call it. You know, so what's your sense of whether this is going to go away? Is she going to be continually sniped at, or can she assert herself?
I think that there's going to be some sniping that continues. Look, these members that come out and say these sorts of things, it's good for them politically, perhaps, in their district, because they take that whole issue away. They just say, oh, you know, look, I voted against her, or I said something negative against her. Now let's talk about something else. So, you know, most members' behavior, I've learned over the years, can be understood as, you know, looking out for their interest and their best interest, and that's what they're going to do. So in this particular case, I think this is a way of getting what could be a contentious issue off their back so they can go on and talk about those issues that are more appealing to them and that elevate their standing in their districts. But I don't think that it's going to affect her. I think that Mrs. Pelosi is, as she always does, which is why she remains popular in her caucus. She will continue to take the pulse of the caucus. She will continue to work with the caucus, and I think she'll make decisions with respect to the campaign strategy for 2018 as well as her own plans based on what she thinks is best for the caucus.
But just in closing, though, John Lawrence, given that it's been so easy to paint Nancy Pelosi, as the Republicans have done, as this uber-liberal from this gay-loving sanctuary city, San Francisco. I mean, it's a cliche. She's like a poster girl for all of the Republican canards. Would you be better off with some macho liberal from rural America who drives a pickup truck?
Look, you know, I were, as you noted at the outset of this discussion, I worked in Congress for a long time. I remember the Republicans going after Tip O'Neill as big, fat, and out of control. I remember them going after Jim Wright as a criminal. I remember them going after Tom Foley. You know, this is what you do. You go after your opponent, and you characterize them. We could have the poster child for bipartisanship as the Democratic leader, and I guarantee you that the Republicans would come after that poster child as though he were an axe murderer, because that's what they do. So you can't design your political strategy, and you certainly can't select your political leaders on the expectation that the opponents, particularly in a highly polarized, highly partisan atmosphere like the House of Representatives, are going to treat you nicely. They will villainize whoever it is that the Democrats would select, and I think most Democrats realize that, and they're going to pick the person not who makes the Republicans feel best, but who's most effective for the Democratic caucus.
Well, John Lawrence, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, John. Again, I've been speaking with John Lawrence, a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's chief of staff. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.